London Column. This is Peter Watson once again presenting a weekly radio digest of items headline or modest, but all selected for your interest and entertainment from the worldwide services of the BBC. London Column. Today we bring you the voice of Mr. Winston Churchill. We have an eyewitness account of television's contribution to the study of ophthalmic surgery, and we join Her Majesty the Queen in the review of her territorial army in Northern Ireland. First then, to a royal occasion at Belfast in Northern Ireland. Only 3 years since the Territorial Army of Northern Ireland was established. But now, on the vast military arena outside Belfast, over 2,000 men and women are on parade, with 500 youths of the Army Cadet Force. Queen Elizabeth, greeted by a salute of 21 guns, accompanied by the Governor of Northern Ireland, and braving a gusty downpour of rain, is to present colours to the 5th Territorial Battalion of the Royal Inniskilling Fusiliers and to the 5th Territorial Battalion of the Royal Irish Fusiliers, and watched by our reporter, Frank Gillard.
To review the mass parade, Her Majesty travelled round the ranks in a closed jeep, sitting beside the driver. The Chaplain General conducted the service of consecration of the new colours, and then, putting on a raincoat, the Queen stepped from the saluting base to present the colours to the colour officers with all the traditional ceremonial. In her speech, the Queen said that this was the first time colours had been presented to battalions of the Territorial Army in Northern Ireland. Her Majesty went on.
By virtue of their consecration, and of the veneration in which they are held, they are the sacred emblems of a threefold regimental loyalty to God, to King, and country. Nor are these colors any less significant because they have not been in battle. But I would remind you that they must be the rallying point in peace, as they used to be in war. Indeed, by devoting to them the soldierly qualities of loyalty, discipline, and self-sacrifice, you can help to maintain the strength of our armies, which is ever the best defense against another war. By giving up your spare time to voluntary service, you have shown that you appreciate your country's need and are willing to do all you can to help.
So, to the music of the national anthem played as a slow march, the colours moved to their battalions. The parade gave 3 cheers for Her Majesty, and as the skies cleared, the march past began. First, to the normal marching step, the main body, headed by the 2 battalions which had received their colours. Then, at the very end, to the quicker step of a rifle regiment, the Royal Ulster Rifles, with the crowds applauding them as they passed the saluting place.
In London, the Australian Prime Minister has been guest of honour at a dinner at which many distinguished voices, including his own and that of Britain's Prime Minister, Mr. Attlee, made grave reference to the challenge to the rule of law now confronting the free world in the Eastern Hemisphere. That Britain sees her duty and intends to discharge it in complete unity of all political parties was firmly voiced by the leader of the opposition, Mr. Winston Churchill.
Is it a moment in the history of the world in which great tension exists. I think myself the tension will be prolonged. I do not see at all how it is going to be eased. All we can do amid these difficulties is our duty. And I am quite sure of this, that any step which His Majesty's government may take in accordance with the broad themes on which we are all agreed and which do not need to be expounded will receive strong support from those who, on domestic matters, differ markedly from him and his colleagues. But at any rate, of one thing I am absolutely sure, that whatever are the divisions of the English-speaking, of the British Commonwealths, of nations, and whatever are the divisions of the English-speaking world, for I have the ambassador of the United States at our side, whatever are all these internal divisions, on the supreme issues which may be brought before us, we shall act as one, we shall stand together, we shall die or conquer. The cause is far above anything which party or domestic politics can concern, but which carry with them, as we all believe, the salvation and the progress of the whole human race.
Removed from political strife are the men of science who devote their skill to the alleviation of human sickness and suffering. Among them, the ophthalmic surgeons who would safeguard the world's eyesight. From all over the world, 2,000 ophthalmic surgeons recently came to London for an international congress and to see British surgeons at work. To aid the watchers, television was called in, and our reporters saw two operations for the removal of cataracts performed. Under a blaze of light and under the telephoto lens of a TV camera mounted 2 feet or so above the patient's head. Here is the story told afterwards by our observer, René Cutforth.
Apart from the concentration of light over the patient's head, the room was in twilight, and in the darkest corner, a television screen, 12 inches by 10, glowed green, gave out its assortment of stripes and waves as it tuned in, and then suddenly presented a very clear picture of the patient's eye, filling almost the entire screen. The surgeon wore a pair of very small, square-cut spectacles which he could look over for normal vision, and two of the foreign delegates were wearing half-circular glasses. Presumably they saw more with them than I could see. Watching the surgeon's fingers and the patient's eye, I was conscious of not much more than a delicate and meticulous series of inconceivably minute movements, unhurried, obviously purposeful, but from my distance of about a yard and a half, not at all clear and comprehensible. I'm not saying that another specialist couldn't have followed them, but they meant very little to me. Just before the surgeon finished the operation with his gentle, reassuring instruction to the patient, "Now close your eyes, madam," I looked over my shoulder at the television screen. The eye, which looked out of it now, had a dark, clear pupil. The white, stony-looking film had gone. For the next operation, I went down the corridor to the television screens which had been set up in two spare consulting rooms. Here, in semi-darkness, nurses and delegates from abroad were sitting in chairs up to 12 feet away from the screen. About 20 of them could follow the operation in each room, for the telephoto lens magnifies the eye 9 times. This time, the operation was easy to follow. The direction and purpose of each deft movement of needle and knife was apparent even to me. So deft the movements were that the difficulty and delicacy of what was going on was hardly apparent, except when from time to time the surgeon's thumbnail appeared on the edge of the screen to serve as a reminder of the scale. It was almost incredible that so large a thumb could be engaged in so small an action. We could hear the surgeon's calm voice asking for instruments, remarking on technical points of interest, giving instructions. His final, "Now close your eyes," brought the demonstration to an end. The screen dissolved in flickers and stripes. An excited hum of discussion broke out in half a dozen languages. A Frenchman next to me said excitedly, "Marvelous, marvelous." I don't know whether he meant the operation or the new way of watching it. Both seemed marvelous to me.
Postscript from guest London columnist MacDonald Hastings. Mac.
While Mr. Churchill and the Queen speak in solemn words of the imminent danger surrounding us in the world today, a BBC reporter attends a television demonstration of one of those wonderful surgical operations that science is now able to perform on the human eye. Listening to London Column this week, I've been wondering whether I would have preferred to have lived in a safer, less terrifyingly eventful age. How pleasant it must have been to have lived in the solid security of Victorian times. The English pound, like the American dollar, was a golden coin. The idea of a world war, as we understand it, was unthinkable. And the Western Hemisphere was as safe and as comfortable as it's ever been in history. Unless, of course, you happen to get an appendicitis or a dicky heart, or perhaps a cataract in your eye. Only 50, 60 years ago, the doctors couldn't do much for you. True, there was no atom bomb to fear, but neither was there any penicillin or sulfamilamide. Surgery, by contemporary standards, was about as primitive as the first wooden aeroplane. There was no chance that you'd be blown up in your home by a bomb, but equally, if you were taken seriously ill, there was very little chance that the doctors could do anything to save your life. Choosing between the two worlds, I'm personally in no doubt that I prefer the miracle of modern living with all its comforts and diversions, as well as its attendant risk, to the sort of existence that people had, well, only 50 years ago. Of course, life in our own time would be even better without the constant threat of a world war always more terrifying in prospect than the one that preceded it. But I think it's important to remember that so many of the wonderful scientific discoveries and mechanical inventions that we enjoy in this age have been developed as a direct consequence of the urgent challenge of war itself. We can be quite sure that but for two world wars, radio, television, radar, automobiles, aircraft, never mind medical science, without the demanding necessity of war, none of those things would have advanced at such a rate. A rate so astounding that it changed the face of the world in half a century. When we do get a period of peace again, if we ever do get real peace again, then also this period of inventive expansion will almost certainly slow down. Meanwhile, well, ask yourself whether you'd trade in for the miracle of modern medicine to rid the world of the menace of the atom bomb. Think carefully. I'm sure you agree with me. Goodbye.
And it's goodbye too from this edition of London Column, a radio digest presented by Peter Watson, produced this week by Peggy Broadhead, and which came to you in the North American service of the BBC.
That was London Column, a transcribed program. This is the British Broadcasting Corporation.